New World Order, have a conspiracy in the old sense of Big Brother. That's Venice, and it's gone. Big Brother, the Illuminati aren't in charge anymore. So that's Venice submerged. What body would that be? I would say that's a TV body. Then the lifestyle you deserve, you're able to make up any situation you want. So that would be the chip body. Creationism would be, what ones have I not said? Chemical, TV, and chip. Astrobody would be a negative light. And then the mystery body would be He is Risen. And the hexad body, the sixth, would be creationism. Creating your own intergalactic, what did Ian call it today? Terra firma. Your own terra firma. Wow. I think I put it together. I brought order out of chaos. I made it up with impromptu, improvised pattern recognition. Did it make sense?
Yes.
It did. You have no choice. You haven't got a counter interpretation, have you? You want to improve on what I did? You want to do it? Show me how the title.
No, I agree.
You agree. Very easy. No, it's interesting. The New World Order is a chemical body. The negative light is the astral body. Venice submerged was the TV body. The lifestyle you deserve is a chip body. And He is Risen is the mystery body, and creationism is the hexadic body. Like we're creating a new world in the hexad with Ion's Icelic mandate. We are creating a new world. It's a new beginning. It's what the biblical creationism was trying to explain and had no clue. And recent talking with Ion about the details of certain parts of the Bible have rubbed that home, smacked it into my brain. It's quite obvious that the Bible could not be interpreted or understood until this week. This week we are getting a clue on it, plus what we did with Rewrite and the Revelation series, which I recommend you listen to again, Roxy. But did you carry on your project to go back and re-listen to everything starting at the beginning of the cash flows? Did you get interrupted by other matters on that project?
Yes, but I did a lot.
Ah, what was it like?
Well, very revealing, because I told you there were things that I thought I understood, but now I have a different view or perspective on many.
Of some of the cliche themes, some of the themes that...
Yes, and I understood in a way why is it that we have to ask. Because if they will just be saying things, that will become like a dogma.
Yes.
And making us ask, wondering, is more like making you wonder and
stopping the dogmatic tendency
by the mystery.
Yeah.
And,
the mystery of meaning.
Yeah, it forced your audience participation.
Right.
Your research, your thinking. So it activates other aspects of you that will not be activated if you would just say, okay, this is the information.
That's beautiful. That's a wonderful explanation.
It will become like a cult.
Yeah.
We have to squeeze them, because it's a way of... I think humans in the fallen state always needed these stories and needs and mysteries, because, looking for answers of those questions is what has moved humanity,
right?
Since the fall, the trying to find the answers and to understand, to overlay.
Yeah, and wonder why the mind demands answers. Always fighting off the mind's efforts to become stagnant and paralyzed. The mind loves that. Also, the mind likes
change. It's also clear why they will say that's old school, that's no longer like that, things are changing. So that we don't stop, like, we think, oh, I've been listening for so long, I know now.
Right.
Because everything is becoming and
becoming.
It's been such a transformation, such a reset that, we better start deep listening.
Deep listening to Cashflow. Well, how does James Martinez come across, re-listening to him?
Well, I think he was sort of fun, sympathetic.
What?
But I think he was also into this mode that many like to be fighting against something. Like they think it's heroic or good. They think they're changing the system by
resisting.
Yeah, by...
What was the previous word you said? Simpatico? Sympathetic? What was that word?
Yeah. Because some words exist in other languages I speak, so I'm not sure they exist in English. Like, it might not be the right.
What did you mean, though? Sympathetic? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Sympathetic. You mean he was trying to stay tuned in? He was sympathetic?
No.
Oh. It was over his head?
No, it's likable.
He's likable. Okay, likable. He was likable. Pleasant.
No, you actually had like a nice atmosphere going on.
Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah. That was nice. Me and James, we had a nice simpatico likableness.
But I think you cannot think of this environment as something, like I say, your only agenda should be to complete, because this is not going to be like your source of income or, I don't know.
Source of prestige, source of anything.
Yes.
At best, the source of mystery. So here's a note to what we just played. Zappa, in one of the biographies of Frank Zappa by Neil Slavin called Electric Don Quixote, the story of Frank Zappa, on page 325, Frank answers a question about Enlight, and he says, it was put together out of two unrelated sequences. There's a group of notes in front of this one sequence that just happens to sound like In the Navy from the Village People song. He says, you don't realize it until it's gone by. And then, hey, that's In the Navy. So that's the N. The N, I guess, refers to Navy. And the light part is this sequence that was basically a bunch of very fast and short synthesizer pockets that had the computer title 1,000 Points of Light. So you have very fast short synthesizer pockets. That would be dropping into different body pocket dimensions, as Ion calls it, flipping in and out, interdimensional five-body transition. And 1,000 points of light would be all the places you're touching on as you slip and slide in body drift. And, of course, you're in the Navy because you're in the water of the circulating bloodstream. So... And there's two unrelated sequences. He puts together two things that are not meant to be in the same room. But he makes it work. Okay, so...
Yes, and that's another thing that I think is interesting from the series of pieces with the differential frequencies that Paulino Oliveras made.
Right.
That you put this frequency, which is beyond your hearing, in the high range and in the lower range, and then you get a third resulting frequency that you can hear, but is non-existent. And this idea of two things coming together and manifesting a third one, I think is really revealing. Like we need dialogue, conversation, and deep listening, because this is how things manifest. The coming together of two. I don't say your newsroom is the thing manifesting, but you always need an audience. You always need somebody to talk to.
Yeah.
And, people had this idea that they could pray to a God and engage in this conversation to manifest or to ask for things, but it's not an outer God that is manifesting what you're asking for. So that's also how, for example, two particles bond together and then they create a new element, and this is part of the becoming, how different things are engaging in new conversations.
Yes.
And changing.
Well, McLuhan had a great line.
All else.
When information brushes against information, the results are often startling and effective. When information is brushed against information. So two unrelated.
Yes, and this is a wonderful mystery of humanity. How Bob has always a quote from McLuhan for everything.
That's right. Yeah, how could that be? How could that be?
Yes. Yes.
Well, it's a skill. It's a talent. It's a knowing. I have a knowing, and I know who.
No, I think he's just like telling you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. My little Marshall, my little whispers in my ear. Oh, over here, Bob.
You're deep listening.
Yeah, I'm deep listening. Now, I think I found an obscure interview with Zappa that I'd like to read. I don't remember ever reading it. But let's see if we find if there's something appropriate to what we've done. So what did we do? We discussed, I know I did the body drift, but what were we doing before that? You were talking, about Pauline.
Well, we were talking some of the similarities also.
Right.
Between Frank and Pauline, and how important is audience participation and listening to as part of real music education, but Pauline goes beyond that. She says it really helps you on your personal and community growth and expands your creativity, your playfulness, your engagement. You can engage in many other things, collaborate, improvise, experiment, expand, and just by learning how to deep listen.
Yes.
It can really change your life. So.
Okay. I think you're right there. So then we did body drift, and then we played In Light to show the music of drifting body drift, and now this article. And then after the article, we will play my dialogue with Don Thiel and how I corrected his book on McLuhan. 3 hours.
Wow.
Or more. 3.5 hours of Bob and Don in the editing room. In the editing room.
This is advanced.
Yes, very, very advanced, Bob. This is Bob without McLuhan helping him. This is Bob. Well, Bob does quote McLuhan probably, but. So, I don't know where this comes from, but let's just see what the article says. It's Frank Zappa. Although primarily considered a composer, Well, that's well into the scene. I don't know if he was ever considered a composer until the 80s or something. So, although primarily considered a composer, Frank Zappa's lyrics reflect his unique approach to rock and roll almost as well as his music does. Combining a theater of the absurd sensibility, sharp-edged satiric humor, and a hair-trigger threshold of outrage, his odes to teenage life, set in a 50s backbeat, are classics of the snide put-down. Always in the vanguard of modern music, Zappa was the first, and is still perhaps the only, musician to bring a classical orientation to the form, producing pieces which certainly might be thought of as symphonic rhythm and blues. With his group, The Mothers of Invention, in the summer of 1967, the infamous Summer of Love, Frank Zappa brought a wicked and spontaneous theatricality to the rock stage at the Garrick Theater long before anyone else was doing it. Since then, Zappa has extended his vision further into the realms of classical music, rock, jazz, and R&B. He has also become involved with films, such as his movie 200 Motels. Known for his hostility to reporters, Zappa was nonetheless quite cordial in our meeting at the Golden Gate Motel in Brooklyn, overlooking scenic Sheepshead Bay. So, Frank says, let's see what new patterns. Some of this we'll have heard many times before, but see if there's something new here. Frank says, I didn't start listening to music until I was about 15 years old because my parents weren't too fond of it, and we didn't have a radio or a record player or anything. I think the...
Amazing. That's a real amazing revelation.
Yeah.
I thought he was listening all his life.
Did you say by himself?
Yes.
Yeah.
Type of music.
Well, he wasn't even listening. He was actually making chemistry at that point, blowing up things. He was not an ear person. He was tactile and engaged in...
But that makes him even more amazing because he starts listening when he's 15 and then he becomes a great composer just like that.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Right. Good point. And he says, I think the first music that I heard that I liked was Arab music. And I don't know where I ever ran into it, but I heard it someplace and that got me off right away. Then I heard a song called I by the Velvets on the Red Robin label, and G and Shaboom, Riot and Cell Block Number 9, and Annie Had a Baby. By accident, I heard those things, and they knocked me out. And he says, I didn't start writing songs per se until I was about 20 years old, 21 maybe. I mean, that's 61, 62. He's going to be on Steve Allen in 63. You're right. He starts real late, starts composing, and all of a sudden he's on TV.
I think he was Francesco Zappa and claiming these things like Leonardo.
That's right. He didn't need to have any education. He already had been doing it for 200 years. That's a good point. Yes, this could be proof that he's Francesco. I didn't start writing songs per se until I was about 20 years old, 21 maybe, because all my compositions prior to that time had been orchestral or chamber music. So he's talking about writing songs. Okay, so he started composing chamber stuff when he was 14 or so, before he even heard any music. Yeah, he started composing before he heard any music. Yes, Francesco. But then he wrote songs when he was 20, 21. I think the basic idea of being a composer is if you're going to be true to yourself and write what you like, you write what you like without worrying whether it's going to be academically suitable or whether it's going to make any mark in history or not. My basic drive for writing anything down is I want to hear it. The very first tunes that I wrote were 50s doo-wop, Memories of El Monte, which actually became a small hit, Memories of El Monte, and stuff like that. It's always been my contention that the music that was happening during the 50s has been one of the finest things that ever happened to American music, and I loved it. I would agree with them there. I could sit down and write 100 more of the 1950s-type songs right now and enjoy every minute of it. I think my writing is as influenced, however, by country blues as it is by 1950 stuff. I've always been fond of Muddy Waters, Lightning Slim, Howlin' Wolf, and those guys. At the time, I was living in a part of town called Echo Park, Now, this would be the little house that you can go on my timeline, about 1997, and we visit the little house at 1819 Bellevue Avenue. So he says, at the time, I was living in a part of town, and he had just been gotten out of jail for being in jail for 10 days or something, kicked out of Cucamonga and lost his studio and everything. At the time, I was living in a part of town called Echo Park in Los Angeles, which was a Mexican, Japanese, Filipino, black neighborhood, and I lived in a little two-room place, grubby little place on the side of a hill, 1819 Bellevue Avenue. So you go to the summer 1997 on my timeline, and you can see me visiting that place with Carolyn, Scott, and Jerry Fiocca. In that house,
but
I wrote...
Being in such an environment may have allowed him to be exposed to many types of music.
Yes.
Other sounds like sound landscapes.
Right.
Do you think maybe he had the same station as Pauline?
Oh, yeah. No, he had Pacifica's L.A. station, which is KPFK. Berkeley is KPFA. They're both part of the same Pacifica network. And he actually, I think he got on it very early. He did get on the St. Mary's College station. He wasn't even a student. And he pretended to be a student, got on the college radio, and had a show about for a week before he got caught. And he got to play all the different... He did an early version of me, played what he wanted to play, you know, different things. So, let's see. He wrote in that little place, in that little house, he wrote Who Are the Brain Police? Oh, No, I Don't Believe It, Hungry Freaks, Bowtie Daddy, and five or six others. A lot of the songs off the first album, known as Freakout, had already been written for 2 or 3 years before the album came out. So when he started writing, early 60s, he started writing a lot. And a lot of songs wouldn't come out until the third or fourth album. So a lot of the songs off the first album, written 2 or 3 years before the album came out, and a lot of songs, other ones, wouldn't come out until the third or fourth later albums. About 50% of the songs were concerned with the events of 1965. That's the Watts Riot. Also when he was in jail and when he got out and he goes to L.A. and the new scene starts. Los Angeles at that time, in the kiddie community that I was hanging out in, he's calling it kiddie community, the world of college dropouts and stuff, they were all getting into acid very heavily. And you had people seeing God in colors and flaking out all over the place. That would have been fun. You had plenty of that. And meanwhile, there was all that racial tension building up in Watts. I was up to San Francisco once or twice, but I wasn't interested or influenced by the scene there. Basically, I thought what was happening in San Francisco, along with Pauline Olivero in that early stage, was dot, dot, dot. Well, I'll tell you what I saw when I went there. Okay, so here he is moving into Pauline's scene. Basically, I thought what was happening in San Francisco in that early stage was, pause. Well, I'll tell you what I saw when I went there. Whereas in L.A. you had people freaking out, that is, making their own clothes, dressing however they want to dress, wearing their hair out, that is, being as weird as they wanted to be in public, and everybody going in separate directions, I got to San Francisco and found everybody dressed up in 1890s garb, all pretty specific codified dress. It was like an extension of high school, where one type of shoe is the in-shoe, belt-in-the-back peggers, or something like that. It was in the same sort of vein, but it was the costume of the 1890s. It was cute, but it wasn't as evolved as what was going on in L.A. In San Francisco, they had a more rustic-than-thou approach. Everybody's trying to be more rustic than you. From there, Zappa and the Mothers moved on to New York in the summer of 1967. Frank says, there wasn't too much going on in the village, in Greenwich Village. There wasn't too much going on in the village that interested me. Didn't interest him. The people who came to see us at the Garrick mostly had short hair. They came from middle-class white Jewish environments, mostly suburban. They came to see our show because we were something weird that was on that street, and we were sort of specialized recreational facility. He talks about this recreational facility, human engineering stuff, in the notes to We're Only for the Money. We're only in it for the money. So the reason they were shocked in those days was that they hadn't seen or heard anything that came close to what we were doing. Now, No, he says, now, after so many groups imitating various aspects of what we did, they've seen it from other sources. Take, for instance, Alice Cooper. Basically, what they're... Remember, he was the first to sign Alice Cooper. Basically, what they're doing is a cosmeticized version of the same thing we were doing in 1967. He's taken the obvious showmanship aspects without doing the difficult musical things. By simplifying the music to the point where you don't have to worry about it too much, and doing it with a lot of lights and a lot of props, you can put together a show that can have wider appeal. Then the journalist says, eventually our discussion shifted to his feelings about lyric writing. Quote, Frank says, I think that by the time I put a lyric down on a piece of paper and go through all the drudgery of setting it to a musical format and rehearsing it and so forth, that they're all reasonably successful in saying what they were intended to say. There's plenty more that could be said, but there are mechanical obstacles in the way of getting that out to an audience. I think there are lots of things that I'd love to be able to express to people in lyrics, but being sort of a rational person, I sit down and figure it out. Do those people really want to know? And is it worth the trouble to write it out, rehearse it, perform it, night after night, record it? I don't understand what he's saying there. But being sort of a rational person, I sit down and figure out, well, I guess this is what he thinks about. Do those people really want to know? Is it worth the trouble to write it out, rehearse it, perform it night after night, and record it? Just to express my point of view on a subject when it's none of my business to inform somebody else about it in the first place. So he thinks about just to express my point of view on a subject when it's none of my business to inform somebody else about it in the first place. That's a pretty ionic view there, or what sometimes ion sounds like. Just to express my point of view on a subject when it's none of my business to inform somebody else about it in the first place. Basically, what people want to hear in a song is, I love you, is I love you, you love me. I'm okay, you're okay. The leaves turn brown, the leaves turn brown, they fell off the trees. The wind was blowing, it got cold, it rained, it stopped raining. You went away, my heart broke, you came back, and my heart was okay. I think basically that is deep down what everybody wants to hear. It's been proven by numbers. So you start to think about the performer's role as an entertainer and that the audience is paying money to come there and see you do something that will basically gratify them. And I have a conflict where I believe that people are entitled to get off as much as they can, and I think entertainers ought to do just that. However, I don't merely want to go out there and bullshit my way through a show. I want some substance, too. So I have to mix it up a little bit and do some of the things that people wish to have done before their very eyes on stage. And at the same time, keep myself from going crazy by writing down some of the things I want to hear. Usually after I finish writing a song, that's it. It doesn't belong to me anymore. When I'm working on a song, it takes weeks and weeks to finish, and the orchestra stuff takes even longer than that. It's like working on a construction of an airplane. Now, he talks about working on an airplane on Lumpy Gravy, one of the characters. So that's interesting. It's a metaphor for him. It's like working on a construction of an airplane. One week you're a riveter, or you're putting the wiring in, or something like that. It's just a job you do, and then you go on to the next step, which is learning how to perform it or teaching it to somebody else. I feel that all the material I've written, as far as my own appreciation of it, goes through a cycle where, especially if it's something I'm going to record, where you work on it so much that by the time you finish it, you can't stand it anymore. I'll read that again. I feel that all the material I've written, as far as my own appreciation of it, goes through a cycle where, especially if it's something I'm going to record, where you work on it so much that by the time you finish it, you can't stand it anymore. You know, you just get saturated with it. When you get to hear it played right, when you get to hear it played correctly or right for the first couple of times, that's the get-off. After that, I don't like it again until it's a few years old and it's been recorded, and I'll pick up the record and I'll say, that's hip. That's he has in the animation dental hygiene thing. He has Jeff Simmons, the cartoon thing in 200 Motels. He goes, that's hip. So he's mocking himself. And I'll pick up the record and I'll say, that's hip. Who Are the Brain Police was a phenomena because I was just sitting in the kitchen at the Bellevue Avenue house and I was working on Oh No, I Don't Believe It, which didn't have lyrics at the time. And I heard, it was just like there was somebody standing over my shoulder telling me those lyrics, and it was really weird. I looked around. I mean, it wasn't like, hey, Frank, listen to this, but it was there. So I just wrote it down and figured the proper setting for it. He was fucking channeling. or something similar. He's saying there was somebody there.
You?
Yes, it was me.
You said you put all these things there.
I can't hide it from you. You know it was me. And I was working on Oh No, I Don't Believe It, which didn't have lyrics at the time. And I heard. It was just like there was somebody standing over my shoulder telling me those lyrics, and it was really weird. I looked around. I mean, it wasn't like, it wasn't like, hey, Frank, listen to this. But it was there, like someone saying that. So I just wrote it down and figured the proper setting for it. The journalist says, I remarked that Zappa seemed to be drifting away from the kind of social protest that characterized his early albums. This interview must be the early 70s. So he says, I haven't become less conscious. It's just that I don't feel a driving need to write songs that are so obvious to everybody. We have one in the show now that's obvious to everybody, with some Richard Nixon jive in it. But I'd rather write Penguin in Bondage. My experiences have changed. They're getting less specific in certain ways, more specific in others. No, actually, this interview would be 74, 75. He says, it used to be that I would write specific things about obvious social phenomena that a large number of people could identify with because they had seen it in action. But that's less specific in terms of my own personal experience. You know, I could observe something happen that may or may not have happened to me personally, and I could still write about it. These days, such weird things have happened to me as a person that I'd rather put some of those down and do it that way. That's why I have songs like Penguin and Bondage and Montana. I write about the things that are part of my personal experience. Then the journalist says, Montana, which is in part about a man who dreams of raising dental floss on a ranch in Montana, started out this way. And Frank says, I got up one day, looked at a box of dental floss and said, I assumed that nobody had done the same thing, and I felt it was my duty as an observer of dental floss to express my relationship to the package. So I went downstairs and I sat at the typewriter and I wrote a song about it. I've never been to Montana, but I understand there's only 500,000 people in the whole state. He actually says 450,000. It has a lot of things going for it, plenty of space for the production of dental floss. And the idea of traveling along the empty wasteland with a very short horse and a very large tweezer, grabbing the dental floss sprout as it pooches up from the bush, grabbing it with your tweezers and towing it all the way back to the bunkhouse, would be something good to imagine. So he liked imagining that.
He's doing the Don Quixote.
Yes, right. The journalist says, I asked how extensively he revised. Sometimes I show the lyrics to my wife, or after a while I'll get her to read them to me so I can see what the sounds are like. Because part of the texts are put together phonetically, as well as what the information is supposed to be. I change lyrics all the time. A lot of them get changed by accident. Somebody will read them wrong, and it'll sound so funny, I'll leave it wrong. I've always hated poetry quite a bit. I really hate it. The whole idea of poetry just makes me gag. And usually people who produce poetry, I don't like to make sociological generalizations, but that's not something I readily identify with, the suffering and the pumping on the chest with the closed fist, bowing of the head, leaves falling off the trees, the wind coming up and all that shit. I hate it. And he says, I don't like books. I very seldom read. My wife and I have a joke because she likes to read. I say there's two things wrong with the world today. One of them is the writers and the other is the readers. So he's against the Gutenberg galaxy here. The main thing wrong with writers is that they're dealing with something that is almost obsolete. But they don't know it yet, which is language. Here's the McCollum part. Language, as a byproduct of the technological growth of civilization, has, well, think of what's happened to the English language as a result of advertising sloganism. The meanings of words have been corrupted to the point where, from a semanticist point of view, how can you convey an accurate piece of information with this language? I'm not saying writers should be replaced. I feel sorry for them. They have a problem similar to people who write music. It's just as hard to write an accurate musical concept down on a piece of paper because of the new techniques in all instruments. The other problem is that I'm not much of a singer, and most of the vocal stuff we put out I've had to give to other people to sing if I wanted to get a listenable performance out of it. Consequently, if they don't say the things with the right inflections, it changes the meaning. There's just bunches of problems in getting the true meaning across. The only guy who's really got it made is a painter. All he's got to worry about is whether his colors are going to fade or whether his canvas is properly stretched, because there's no middleman. He does it, and that's it. He doesn't have to send it through a bunch of other processors. Then he says, I think ideally the way it should be is you could use words for amusement purposes only, because the spoken word, the sound of words, strikes me as funny because of the differences in people's noise-producing mechanisms. But as far as the information communicated in the words, it would be better if people could communicate telepathically. I must have been talking to him. Actually, that's all a bunch of crap. Who needs to worry about all that technical stuff? I'm telling you, folks, I just don't read very much. I don't like books too much. I don't like poetry at all, and that's it. I'll read that again. But as far as the information communicated in the words, it would be better if people could communicate telepathically. So he's talking about how, nothing to do with language.
But, you know, I'm thinking, if you want to promote something, that's a very good way to do it, because this may cause the people who is listening to that to think, why would they like to read, or why would they defend poetry?
Mm.
You know, he makes people think about it and justify or find reasons why these things are valuable. Like, I'm already like thinking.
Right. Yes, it's reverse psychology, reverse sociology.
So,
it's what McLuhan.
So
very similar to McLuhan.
He did that a lot.
What?
He did that a lot. Like, he was provoking people.
Yes. But he's even doing what McLuhan said. McLuhan said, if you don't...
I endorse that also. Like, he provokes you.
Yes, and you're learning how to do
like
it.
That,
you're just starting. You practiced last night at the party. You started to learn how to be a provocateur, right?
No.
No?
But, no. I agree with everybody.
No, you said Karl Marx provoked them. What's the greatest poet who ever lived, Karl Marx, who never wrote one fucking poem, and you go, Karl Marx. And they go, that's brilliant. That's fucking brilliant. I'm going to do a play. And you said, no, it isn't. I came up with the idea first. So that happened to Roxy, right, last night with the elite artists of Berlin, the culture, what's that term Ion uses? The Politburo, the Cultural Politburo. That's what it sounded like. You went in the Cultural Politburo, the bureaucrats of rearview mirror taste. But anyways, back to this point.
Well, they believe in the academy.
That's right. Now, back to this point about Zappa as a provocateur. Remember McLuhan said,
yes,
if you want them to read Shakespeare.
And you do it, too.
Oh, yes.
You also say things that are very, like,
mean.
You were just saying things.
Mean? I say.
What Pauline Oliveros is limited. If you really listen to the it around, it's not good.
Yes, I always make myself number one. I'm like Ion.
I think that's his technique to to provoke people to think, why is he saying reading is not good or poetry is not?
Yeah.
And that makes you find your own.
Yes.
Reasons why you will value something or at least think about it. And I think he might sometimes sound very radical, but I think he was really doing that as a way.
He's rational.
To make people
very rational. He planned
think about
it out.
Things that maybe they will never think about.
Right.
They're just working and then they watch TV and that's it. And he wanted people to expand and think about other issues.
So my point is it's so appropriate to have them. Who would you put with McLuhan in my tiny note chart? Nobody would imagine Zappa, but we're always finding similarities. Zappa said, I hate poetry. Don't read it. McLuhan did the same thing. If he wanted you to read Shakespeare, he wouldn't get you to read Shakespeare. He wouldn't test you on it. He would take all the pop culture items that you've been watching, movies, music, records and stuff, and he would test you on that. And that would drive you into the arms of Shakespeare. You know, because whatever the teacher is telling you to pay attention to, you're not going to pay attention to. So it's the same reverse sociology as Frank Zappa. So they belong in the same quadrant. So we're coming up to the end of this interview. So
yes, or Ion is saying the most wonderful music is Vesta Goodman.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, and all the composers puke and don't know why. You know, well, you didn't hear Steve's recording, but he said the one. In my mind, I'm wondering. So the article says, the journalist writes, picking up an earlier thread, I asked Zappa if he didn't think it was the artist's responsibility to educate those who know less than he does. And so if he didn't think, and he says he didn't. But we're now going to read the quote, but so I don't know what that's, too many double negatives. I asked Zappa if he didn't think it was the artist's responsibility to educate those who know less than he does. He didn't.
But in a way, that's a lie, because he was really, his whole music,
he even talked about it. He talked about that he was educating people. But what does this mean? He didn't think it was the artist's responsibility to educate those who know less than he does. He didn't.
Well, because he doesn't want to think of people like less than.
Right.
Or he's more than, but he just wants to present things that he thinks are more.
You're muffling. Don't get muffled. Fix your voice there. What did you say? He doesn't what?
Yeah, for example, in the case of music, he wanted to present music that he thinks is more interesting in all aspects of.
Yeah.
All musical aspects, like more complex rhythm, more interesting text, interesting instrumentation, interesting improvisation, interesting collaborations between the responses between the musicians that are not maybe conventional, audience participation, and all these things that that were very pedagogical.
Very what? Iconical.
Pedagogical.
Oh, pedagogical, yes, teaching. Yes.
Yeah, and fun. And that's something Pauline also does.
Yes. Okay, listen to what he says. I don't know if he didn't think it was the... I asked Zappa if he didn't think it was the artist's responsibility to educate those who know less than he does. He didn't. So it seems to be anti-pedagogical. But then he says, it's hard for people to imagine that somebody else knows something they don't know. And suppose you actually do know something that somebody else doesn't know, and you want to tell them about it. Well, you've got a problem, because, first of all, they don't want to know. And if it's you saying, quote, if you knew this, you might be better off, unquote, then you have to sit there and say to yourself, do I really want to tell them that? Will it make them feel better? Will it do them any good if they know? I realistically look at it this way. It doesn't work. I think that it's quite possible that what I have to say is useful only to very few people, and I should not bust my ass to make it available to a large number of people, because first of all, they can't use it. Second of all, they probably don't need it. And third of all, I know they don't want it. So kiss it off and boogie.
So,
that's
the greatest phrase ever. Kiss it off and boogie.
That's the greatest phrase? You like that?
Phrase, yeah.
You ever heard it before?
Boogie. No.
You'll be using it, I imagine. And you remember it. Kiss it off and boogie. Why then, so the journalist says, why then, I continue, would an artist keep making records? Why would an artist keep making records? Frank says, I think in contemporary America, most artists try to make records so that they can eat. That's all he says. Why do people make artists making records? Well, so they can eat. Finally, the journalist says, I started clutching at straws. Didn't you ever have something you said get through to someone else in a positive way, I asked? Right, remember he's saying it's pretty hard to get someone interested in what you're interested in. Didn't you ever have something you said get through to someone else in a positive way, I asked. He says, yes. And how did you feel, says the journalist. All I knew was that I was tired. That's Frank's answer. After he spent hours trying to get someone to notice something. He was exhausted. Well, we are not exhausted, but you probably are, so we'll end the show, this amazing Zappa special that we did without Bert. I don't know how we did it without Bert, but Bert will be back next week to fill in with his charming...
Without his charming laughter.
Yes, charming patois. So, you learned a lot tonight. I learned a lot. Everybody learned a lot. It was synergy up the yin-yang. And apparently I'm going to be learning a little bit more as soon as I hang up. So we will come back. I don't know what time. Five. Okay, that would be 6, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11, 12. I think JW might be a bit late. So we'll just monitor it. The earliest would be 5 o'clock. So here it is, almost 3 hours left before 5 o'clock, quarter to 2, and I'm going to play 3.5 hours of Don Thiel and Me. Now, Roxy, I want you to listen and note, it seems to be dropouts. I'll be saying something, and all of a sudden, I didn't finish it, and it's some Don saying something else. When I digitally transferred it from the cassette tape into a QuickTime, I noticed there seemed to be gaps. So let me know what you hear or confirm the general thing, or maybe it got fixed magically. But this is Bob and Don Thiel in January. That's the date. January
24th, 1999.
Wow, the Titans. Yeah, the Titans. So Roxy, you're welcome to come back and talk to Ion in many hours from now. Email me if you're not going to do it or if you're going to do something else so I know what to do. All right?
But yes, I would like to.
I think you're going to like this Don Thiel stuff. You like Don Thiel. You looked into him for a few minutes. He's part of your intellectual history. So this is Don and Bob looking over Don's new book called The Virtual Marsh McLuhan. He wrote a book on McLuhan, one of the best books in 1971. He said he'd never write another book. But what happened was, oh, there's Bill. I must have not hooked on a Skype. He's hooking up my Skype. So he said he'd never write another book. That's 40 years ago. But circumstances led him to be getting mad because Terrence Gordon's book, Biography of McLuhan, put down Don. So he didn't like that. So he wrote his book to get back at everybody. And the book came out in 2001 or 2002, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan. So...
Well, I really think his scolia really expands a lot.
You're talking about Don Thiel?
Yes,
he's in scolia, in leisure, school as leisure.
Yeah, he's like commenting on the Bible.
Yes.
Mr. He helps in many ways to really get the deeper McLuhan.
Right. Did you just say he writes on the Bible and Is that what you said he wrote? He writes on the Bible and McLuhan?
On the work of Marshall McLuhan.
Yes.
Like the scholars were commenting on the margins of the Bible.
And this man, Don Thiel, was president of Trent University in the 80s, and he said to Michael Edmonds, Bob is the mantle of McLuhan. The torch is passed to Bob. So he said that years ago, and we're now, well, he was right, but it's a lot different than what we thought it would lead to. So I rest your case, Roxana. It's your case. I rest it. Hope I did a good job.
Okay, Professor Bob.
Okay, so I'll hang. Do I hang up? No, I want to listen to this.
Yes.
All right.
Well,
Okay, I think I'll mute everybody. I don't know if there's anybody.
Yes,
thank you very much for the zap.
When Ion is there, I will be glad to.
Okay.
To ask him something. Yes.
All right. I'm refreshing the page. There's hardly anybody on the calling in page. Okay, so let's start. I'm going to mute everybody.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'm going to hang up.
Okay, great. Thank you. Bye for now.
Thank you.
Yep.